Bailing out Wall Street is the only way to save Main Street, so says the president.
And in the last 24 hours, many founders, investors that I've talked to have been desperately trying to get their money out.
We are at the beginning of a very classic late cycle, late big cycle debt crisis.
Can you characterize everything that the Fed has done this past week as essentially flooding the system with money?
Yes.
The Bitcoin system is so perfect that I think it's going to be the future.
Hey, Dave, how's it going?
Hey, it's going well, David. How are you?
Doing well. So I think the main thing that everybody's talking about is the price action was, it even surprised me. And like, I've had this, it's funny because I think that people think like, oh, wow, this is, I know this will happen. Like, I've at least told myself like mentally that like, you know, the confluence of factors will cause this to happen around this time. I was thinking that like over the summer, like I was like, there's no way this thing doesn't rip like later on. But seeing
it
happen.
Wait, back up. Tell us, what is it that happened?
Oh, yeah. The dollar exchange rate of Bitcoin has risen dramatically over this past week. I think 20% in the last 5 days.
Wow.
And it has broken new records or new all-time highs in other currencies other than the dollar, which really goes to show you that since the last time Bitcoin was hitting all-time highs, which was in 2021, that shows that the value of those other currencies has decreased more than the dollar since then. So like, you know, all these, I think it's 30 currencies that Bitcoin has reached new to all-time highs in.
Yeah, right. So what that really says is not so much that Bitcoin is worth more than ever before in those countries that use those currencies, but rather that those currencies have devalued against the dollar. So it's like, it's sort of, you know, Bitcoiners are touting the all-time high, but really the story is about the dollar milkshake. These other currencies, which are, you know, the dollar, we complain all the time about how it is being debased, but it's still the best game in town as compared to other fiat currencies. And that's shown by the all-time high in Bitcoin.
Yeah. Yeah.
The price action to 20% in the last 5 days is crazy and face ripping. Actually, to put things in perspective, I heard something that Fred Krueger, who's on X, he comments a lot about ETFs and never go up. And he was saying that you're in the money if you bought Bitcoin pretty much in any time in its history except for like a few days.
Yeah.
So now we're in that. So we haven't seen an all-time high in dollar terms, but we are pretty much out of the woods as far as, you know, wondering whether your investment gave you a return on purchasing power. Now, that said, though, the last time we had an all-time high in Bitcoin was so long ago, not that long ago, it was just a few years, but the rate of inflation in the United States is so aggressive that only in those few years, with all the printing and the COVID bailouts and everything else, that really the all-time high in purchasing power of Bitcoin would only take place at around $79,000 US. And so it's important to keep that in mind. There's going to definitely be some kind of like online celebration when it goes past 69 and up to 70, reaching that all-time high in numeric terms. But that doesn't really count in my book. I think I want to see it up to 79.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. Although I will kind of counter that a little bit with the fact that all-time highs are pretty much universally measured in like nominal terms. That would be wonderful as well to see that. And I think that just, you know, talking about all of the things that have been going on, this new environment where there is just steady institutional buying of Bitcoin makes this like a market that we really haven't seen before for like the dollar exchange rate.
We have not. And it's really wild when you look at the supply of Bitcoin. A couple more stats for people. 20,000 Bitcoin in 2 days were purchased.
Yeah.
By ETF custodians, right? And then you have 900 Bitcoin a day being mined. The great thing about Bitcoin is that it is incredibly predictable, even though it's a volatile asset, but in some respects, extremely predictable, right? So we know exactly how many Bitcoin are created each day. It's 900, period. Can't go up, can't go down, no matter how many more miners come online. And so that contrast is striking because miners typically have to sell some Bitcoin for dollars because they pay for energy in dollars. So mm-hmm. they are constantly kind of leaking supply into the market, but they can't do that much if they're only mining 900 a day total worldwide, and ETF issuers are purchasing 10,000 a day. So yeah. At some point there has to be supply and demand has to collide. Most economics is hand waving, but there is this one iron law of supply and demand that started it all. And so it must hold up.
Yeah, definitely. And just more stats are that, you know, the Bitcoin spot ETFs have had, I think, over 10 billion in inflows now, which is almost to the point of where people were predicting the inflows would be in 2024.
Really?
So Galaxy Research, a pretty well respected like Bitcoin and crypto market research firm, Galaxy is actually partnering with Invesco to create one of the ETFs. I believe Mike Novogratz runs Galaxy. But anyway, they predicted that I think there would be like 13 or 14 billion in inflows in 2024. And we're like almost there within, you know, a month or something like that. So
it's amazing. And yeah. One of the things too, with this run up in the exchange rate is that MicroStrategy, which is Michael Saylor's company, which holds how many, like 150,000 Bitcoin, something like that. I can't remember the number. It's a lot.
Yeah, it's yeah.
And he keeps buying it, and because of the appreciation in the exchange rate, MicroStrategy as a company is now inside the S&P 500 technically now. I don't know how you get officially designated that way, so maybe there's some kind of red tape you have to go through to actually get on that list, but it deserves to be there now. And if that comes to pass, then I think we talked about this last week, but it is extremely interesting that that MicroStrategy could become, which is just a proxy for Bitcoin, let's be honest. Most of its value is backed by Bitcoin that it holds. And if it was in the S&P, then index funds that just track the S&P would suddenly include a built-in Bitcoin exposure, like price exposure. And so you know, that's underreported almost. It's like, not only you have these ETFs, these inflows, you actually now have the S&P 500 is backed by Bitcoin.
Yeah. 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 That's crazy to think about, you know, only 15 years after this thing was like released into the public, it is a part of the S&P 500. And I think that there's got to be corporations that are eyeing what MicroStrategy did, especially after the FASB accounting rule change, which, to give some context on that, up until earlier or like sometime in 2023, when you were a corporation or a publicly traded company that had Bitcoin on your balance sheet, you could only track when the value, you could only report the value of those assets, I believe, like when you sell it or when the value declines, but you couldn't report when the value goes up. Mm-hmm. So if you're a firm that buys, you know, a bunch of Bitcoin and say it like goes down, that reflects on your balance sheet, but not, you know, when it appreciates. And Now those rules have been changed. So it's a mark-to-market reporting where you're basically like just reporting what the kind of close-ish to real time of what it is. And that makes it so much easier for publicly traded companies to have Bitcoin or Bitcoin exposure on their balance sheets.
Yeah, that's incredible. I think that the next step really would be business adoption if it were easy. So I like that signal and it's exciting. It's certainly necessary, but I don't think it's sufficient. I think we need more like friendlier regulation friendlier regulation, right? Because businesses, they're in the business of just like not wanting drama. They're not going to do something if it's going to like, if they're betting the farm that that they're not going to be, gone after for regulatory issues. And so I would like to see, because I think the United States does need to compete in this way with other jurisdictions, I would like to see a lot more proactive steps being taken to make Bitcoin something that is easily interacted with business. Part of it is also tax. Tax and accounting is a real pain, and they make it so difficult. It's unfair, it's an enormous drag. The tax issues and accounting issues, that's the FASB thing is one thing, but there's like a dozen more steps that need to be taken.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, any individual that reports their Bitcoin holdings, especially if you sell some, I think that, you definitely know what we're talking about.
Sell some, but also receive it as income, or even just change its control, send it somewhere. Yeah. All of those things are taxable.
Yeah. Yeah. And so in addition to that, I think it's safe to say that we'll just continue to see more of these ETF inflows. It's interesting. I mean, major firms like Vanguard and all of these, large brokerages, they haven't even given their financial advisors the runway to offer this to clients. So in a sense that this like blockbuster ETF launch has even been kind of muted relative to what it could be. So that's just another crazy stat that like, this is like not even what it might be in the future.
That's really great. Yeah. I mean, in some sense, I love to see the price action. Obviously it's a lot of fun. I remember going through this actually back in 2021, where it is like a mixed emotion, because when Bitcoin's down, you have to deal with certain things, like your friends and family think you're an idiot, right? And you look at your stack and you're like, wow, I overpaid for this Bitcoin. I could have waited and bought it. All these psychological games start playing, but you have the conviction and you're excited to be able to get sats on sale. So there's like that positivity. But now we have the positivity of, it looks like you're much more wealthy if you own Bitcoin. On the other hand, it feels like it's kind of like running away and you'll never get it back. Like the amount of Bitcoin you have might be like basically fixed if it keeps going up, unless you're able to outpace the appreciation of Bitcoin in dollar terms with your own income in dollars, which is incredibly hard as it accelerates. And so there is sort of this like bittersweet emotion of being like, okay, wow, I guess that's it. Like that's how much Bitcoin we all get, unless you're super wealthy, and we'll be happy with that. But it's interesting to kind of feel like that kind of like bittersweet, it's not all roses. It's not all like elation for me. I think it's also like, it's almost like Bitcoin as an asset is growing up and you're saying goodbye to its childhood. And so there's some melancholy there.
Yeah, definitely. And also the fact that, now's the time when you get all the texts from your friends and family. I personally have received, texts inquiring like, wow, wait, Bitcoin's going up. What should I do? And everybody's like, you should buy it. And and then like, that's great. And like, it's like all the people that haven't necessarily like done all of the reading yet, they're like piling in, and they're piling in at, because of the FOMO. And And depending on what happens, you know, it's like that cycle. I think there was a Jan 3's Andrew Howard had a funny meme that it's like this cycle of like, for 3 years, everybody thinks you're stupid, and then they think you're a genius, and then 3 years, and then you're a genius for a year, and then for 3 years, you're stupid. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out with this like cycle that we're heading into.
Absolutely. I mean, it's of course, there's going to be corrections and it's volatile, but I really am holding out hope. I really hope that this is the cycle where we see a dramatic decrease in volatility. It is possible that, you know, with Bitcoin backing the S&P 500, with it being what, you know, kind of a widespread, it becomes part of the recommendation of a lot of financial planners, that the price stabilizes a little bit as people hold on to it for longer periods of time. And it's held kind of in more accounts and it's accessible by larger pools of capital. Hopefully that dampens some of this volatility a little bit. If it does, huge win for Bitcoin education, because frankly, everything would be easier without that variable constantly. You know, you explain how it works, you explain why it's very reliable and dependable. And then, you know, I mean, you even saw Andrew Sorkin being like, well, if it's so dependable, how come the price goes down? You know, if it just could calm down a little bit, I think that would be a huge win.
Yeah, definitely. And especially for the applications that we envision, which are really like fintech focused Bitcoin banking applications. Mm-hmm. I think it would make it a lot more palatable, as opposed to the like exchange business model where you're trading Bitcoin. And I think that represents a step in the like direction of maturity for how Bitcoin is used and thought of.
Yeah.
On that line of thinking, Satoshi, there were some emails released this week. I think a cache from Marty Malmy and also Adam Back had some correspondences with Satoshi that were released during the COPPA versus like Craig Wright trial, which I've heard is not going very well for Craig Wright.
I don't know what to think. It's one of those, like, you know how Scott Adams talks about how people are watching two movies on the same screen. So I don't know. I'm watching this trial and I'm reading like the BitMEX updates on Twitter, and it's like sounds like really disastrous and embarrassing for Craig Wright. And then I look at some of his followers, and they're all like, the guy's killing it, man. Like, he's definitely Satoshi. And like, he keeps bringing it in that courtroom. So, and you know, judges are unpredictable. Who knows? Honestly, until a judge says something, I'm not going to hold out hope. I kind of agree though, because I looked at both sides. I kind of agree with the people who see, I mean, I wasn't in the courtroom, but if the transcripts and the summaries are accurate, then it sounds like Craig Wright was sort of cornered in a few moments in that courtroom where it seemed like he didn't have a clear answer for why some of the documents that he submitted to evidence seemed to be forgeries. So if that's true, then I think perhaps all that
credibility might be shot.
Credibility is over, right? These emails are interesting, probably the most interesting thing that's happened in this whole trial. And, you know, people who are in Bitcoin really believe that Bitcoin is so important that it there's a history to it that deserves to be like documented and preserved for all time, because it was such a huge advance in kind of human technology. And so these emails are a treasure trove. And I've just been watching over the last week, people have been pouring through them and creating new theories about who Satoshi was. And what his intentions were and why he disappeared. So I don't know if you want to get into those. There's actually, I only kind of scratched the surface there. So I didn't, I don't feel like I can really talk intelligently about that, but maybe we should go through it next week because it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that there is a book that contains, it's thick, like a few 500 pages, maybe, of like all of Satoshi's correspondences, but I guess that book might need to be updated. But yeah, I know people that have read it and said it's really interesting to just go through how Satoshi thought about everything. And I think that what, at least from what I was able to skim, you know, his work ethic was pretty clear, commitment to the project, and you just kind of get a sense of somebody who is likely working a full-time job and also just working on this passion project and like really wanting to get it out there. And it's cool to see.
That's great.
Yeah. So I think another topic that you covered in a Forbes article is Coinbase this week. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to go over that.
Sure. Yeah. Well, Coinbase, unfortunately, I mean, I have like a love-hate relationship with Coinbase. They've done a lot of good things and they've done a lot of really quite awful things over the past years that they've been operating. So on the good side, two headlines here. Number one is they made Bitcoin accessible to many, many, many people who otherwise would not have known how or where to get it. Number two, they've been operating for a really long time and they haven't rugged anybody yet. And that's more than most can say. And, I think somebody tweeted a couple months back that I saw, somebody said like, we all like to hate on Coinbase sometimes, but I have a friend who has had the same amount of Bitcoin in his Coinbase account for like 8 years or something. And like, it's just still there and you can still get it. And that's not the case with most other platforms. So that's all good. On the flip side though, they took this, they took a very negative decision in my view at one point to pursue short-term gains by turning their platform into a casino for altcoins. And that has caused human suffering, and it has both on a personal level for people who have lost money because they were indulging in kind of these destructive behaviors. And then it's also, given sort of crypto and Bitcoin this bad name of being something that people just play with in order to like make money at the expense of others. And so that's actually, mm-hmm. I mean, that's for me, we're really mission driven here at Coinbits, and I just can't imagine that I would not turn down the riches that would be associated with that, 'cause I just find it so repulsive. I'm not saying like I'm perfect or that if I were in his shoes, I wouldn't have done what Brian Armstrong did, but I think that there is some reflection that I still haven't ever seen him or anyone else do. He goes on these podcasts and he talks and he gets that question asked to him and he kind of dodges it. So I look at that as sort of like an inauthentic response. And then this week, to see what happened with Bitcoin. So Bitcoin went on this dramatic run up over $60,000, which we just talked about. Coinbase is very important to people. Like that's how a lot of people get their Bitcoin. So they logged in and they were trying to trade, and not only were they unable to trade, not only that, but they logged in to see a zero balance in their accounts.
Yeah.
I heard that from a couple friends. I don't keep a balance on Coinbase, but I wanted to go check it out. So I tried to log in and I couldn't even get to the dashboard. It just locked me out completely. But a lot of people were seeing $0. And so that, again, if you care about this stuff and you want people to feel comfortable with it and confident that that Bitcoin is like a real asset, it's not just steam, it's not some ethereal thing with no value, it's something that's dependable, you can't do that. And mm-hmm. You have to be, the show must go on, like you must be ready. The excuse was, well, we were prepared for more traffic but not quite that much traffic. That's not really an acceptable response either, because we've all been talking for months about how, it's not a sure thing, but with the ETF and with MicroStrategy going the S&P, like this, Bitcoin could have this moment where it shoots up. It always shoots up in a few days. Most of the purchasing power increase of Bitcoin is accrued in a few like days, 10 days per cycle or something like that, right?
Yeah.
So you have to be ready. They weren't ready. And there's a history of this. Like they keep getting, they keep like failing in these big roundup, big windups for Bitcoin. Actually, I didn't know that, but I saw somebody post that this has happened multiple times. So It's very unfortunate. Look, it's up to them. They can run their business however they want. Bitcoin will survive long term either way. But I was disappointed by that, and I hope they kind of took a lesson here. There are other people. I'll just say I didn't write this in my article because it's not founded. But like, what are podcasts for? But to spread rumors. And yeah. I heard people speculating pretty strongly that. You know, Coinbase is a public company, like, right? So the CFO of a public company is in for most at all C levels in a public company, you're basically an extension of the state. Peter Thiel said this at the Bitcoin conference a couple years ago. And so you know, Coinbase is involved in lobbying, and they have connections in Washington. And so it's not so much that they're acting at the direction of Washington necessarily, but it's not like there's some independent organization that has like nothing to do with the US government. And, you know, if Bitcoin were to run up super fast, that could be really scary for the regime, which is, you know, its power is derived from the dollar. So is it possible that there's some conspiracy theory that like somehow, some way there was, you know, this shutdown was instigated somehow by the US government? What do you think?
Maybe. I'm not surprised by anything at this point. And I think that I could see it. I think it's kind of silly. Like it's a silly way of doing it. If you wanted to like stop a pump, but you know, crazier things have happened, right?
Look at GameStop.
Look at like the history of FTX or the GameStop. Yeah.
GameStop's was, you know, Robinhood shut down trading when GameStop was about to wipe out huge short positions on Wall Street that were unhedged.
Yeah.
And
And
it was like, whoops, sorry. It was the same answer. Makes you wonder.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely does. And I think that it's funny. That is one thing that I think everybody should be cognizant of, is that like you look at history books and read about all of this rampant corruption between business and government interests, et cetera. One must acknowledge that still happens today. You can't just like read the history books and say like, oh, that was crazy. I can't believe they were so corrupt then. And then not also, you have to make the leap that like, that's also happening today. Very likely. Yeah. So I think, there was also some news about Gemini. Gemini is going to reach like some sort of settlement with Genesis, instigated by, the New York Department of Financial Services, but I'd rather skip that and just get straight into the article that you wrote addressing Jason Zweig. I don't know how to pronounce it, but his Wall Street Journal article, because I really liked what you wrote there, and I think it's an important topic to talk about.
Sure. So Jason Zweig, I guess I would call him Zweig. I don't know.
That sounds right.
He's like a well-known financial writer. He's been writing for Wall Street Journal. He actually wrote for Forbes at one point. He's collaborated on some important books in the psychology and economics field. And he wrote an article that was widely distributed in Wall Street Journal that asked whether Bitcoin could be, deposed or overtaken by other assets. And he used pearls as one example of an asset that used to be much more prized for its purchasing power than it is today. And his other one was technology companies like Atari and BlackBerry and MySpace. And so in the article, in my response in Forbes, I kind of broke it down and said, okay, like, are these metaphors apt? Because there are these researchers at Berkeley, Lakoff and Johnson. I can't remember their first names, but they have written extensively on conceptual metaphor. They're cognitive linguists, and they look at how when you commit to a certain metaphorical reasoning, that you, that there are these entailments. So like, in other words, if you say Bitcoin is like pearls because it has some similarities to pearls, like the value of a pearl is in its proof of work, just like Bitcoin, then you say, okay, but pearls's proof of work was able to be reduced with technology and with innovation over time. And so maybe Bitcoin's proof of work, or not maybe, but that means Bitcoin's proof of work is probably susceptible to the same thing, right? And so in order to understand why that's not true, though, it's complicated. You have to understand a little bit of computer science. You have to understand a little bit of monetary history and the different forms of money that have come before Bitcoin. And you also have to realize that the people who designed the Bitcoin protocol, which were standing on the shoulders of giants because there had been many, many attempts to create digital money.
Yeah.
The people who created it understood these arguments. So if you're going to come in like just, hey, digital pearls, right? You have to, like, there's some due diligence that has to go into like understanding the technology itself and not just assuming that you know what's going on because you understand like pearls. The other thing that he mentioned was Atari, BlackBerry, MySpace, and basically said, there are all these prominent platforms that people are very excited about and committed to, and they have critical mass. You know, they have like millions and millions of users, and then they're overtaken by a better technology. And so that's almost like, for me, that's a little bit more compelling because Bitcoin is technology, and there are problems, quote unquote, with Bitcoin that could be solved. Like, you could make the blockchain more efficient in certain ways. You could do things to make Bitcoin more flexible and useful in other ways. And so it's reasonable to go down that line of reasoning. The only issue there is that Bitcoin isn't a firm. It isn't a business that has a profit incentive. It's a completely different thing. It's a protocol. So it's open source code that anyone can run, and it's money. And money is unique because people tend to gravitate towards using one type of money because that money needs to be very highly liquid. It needs to be highly recognizable, which is something that you don't need. In fact, that could even be a detriment to your technology company if you're building something. You want differentiation if you're building a new phone. But in Bitcoin, in money, you want no differentiation. You want fungibility, reliability, recognizability. And so the network effects of a money are much, much stickier and more powerful than the network effects of any product developed by a firm. Again, it's like, it's a nuance, but it is important that if you're going to kind of like try to understand these issues and decode them for a wide audience of people who they don't know what money is, they haven't thought about it, they've never needed to before. You do need to kind of get deep into the details of what money is. Robert Breedlove is a great Bitcoin philosopher who has a podcast called What is Money? And that's his contribution is just like leading that conversation online. And it's absolutely essential and fantastic, the work that he does. And so, I just wrote all of that in this article and actually sent it to Jason. And I'm hoping that he responds because I'm curious what he would think.
Yeah. And I think that, first of all, just to plug the fact that I didn't know about the evolution of pearls before reading his article, I thought that was cool. Yeah. Also, he has written this very short book called like The Devil's Financial Handbook or Dictionary or something. And it has all these terms of financial like lingo that people on Wall Street use. And he defines it like in a comical way, but also what it actually is.
Oh, cool.
So you like read this book and you like actually know what they mean when they say something. And not in like a, it's not an Oxford dictionary. It's like a, you know, real
like
dictionary.
Ambrose
and
Pierce.
It's a great book. Yeah, exactly. And so credit to him there. And I also think another important point is that it's a protocol and consensus is very important, but like, it's also a protocol that's not like, there are things that are likely to be fixed. Like, I have extreme confidence that the hard cap of 21 million will like stay. Is there like a non-zero sum chance that everybody, that like there's a BIP that everybody runs that like becomes more successful that removes that? Theoretically, right? Am I wrong on that?
No, you're right. Theoretically, that's true. But but that's something we didn't talk about yet, which is game theory.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Like,
so you have to look at incentives. Like, somebody who wants to do that will have to convince everybody who uses Bitcoin that they want to lose a bunch of purchasing power for the purpose of, of increasing the cap. And if that's the case, great. That's still consensus based, and that matters a lot. Bitcoin's voluntary. You know, it's funny, I've been publishing more articles and I get a lot of like hateful comments and where people are just like spouting off a bunch of misunderstandings of Bitcoin and almost feel like they're personally threatened by my articles explaining Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, hey, Bitcoin's voluntary. That's one of the best parts about it. You don't have to participate in this. Nobody's going to make you do it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be over here doing this and you do you. So Bitcoin being voluntary and being something that people voluntarily participate in who don't know each other, who are spread around all around the planet.
Exactly.
And they just opt into this. It's very beautiful.
Yeah. And it's that game theory, I think, is like the really hard. It's a really hard set of like ideas and theory to refute once you get it. Mm-hmm. That consensus, that like kind of like, not like that the consensus backs Bitcoin, but that it kind of does.
Sustains it.
And that
it sustains
like,
it.
Yeah, it sustains it. And so, like, how do you change everybody? It's like, how do you change a decentralized network of people's minds that want a project to succeed?
Right.
So,
right. Cool, man.
Anyway, I think that was we got into some pretty powerful stuff this week. Still managed to dig under the surface, even though Bitcoin is ripping and everybody's just posting, you know, memes about Creed and Bitcoin and all sorts of other like bull market things.
Yeah, it is definitely fun time online. If anybody's not already obsessed with Twitter, it's a good time to get in there.
Yeah.
All right, David. Well, thank you. This is fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And to everybody listening, have a wonderful weekend.
Bye, everyone.
This recording is for informational purposes only. No investment or legal or any other advice should be drawn from this content. And as always, consult an advisor before making any legal or financial decisions. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Bitcoin Roundup podcast presented by Coinbits. So what do you think of the conversation? Share your thoughts with us on Twitter at CoinbitsApp, and be sure to subscribe to be notified of our next episode release. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you next time on the Bitcoin Roundup podcast.